Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, if you like this podcast, go behind the paywall to get privileged access to the smartest minds in finance. Visit realvision.com/RVPod and use the promo code PODCAST10, that's PODCAST10, to get 10% off our essential membership for the first year. Join the Real Vision community and learn how to become a better investor. And now to the top analysis of today's markets.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of My Life in Four Trades. Joining me today is Nancy Davis, founder of Quadratic Capital Management. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to My Life in Four Trades.
Thanks for having me on, Maggie. It's great to see you. I feel like we represent spring is in the air, right? Today.
Yeah, that's right.
Yellow and pink.
I love it. Well, before we jump into your trade, so on My Life in Four Trades, we do two of your best trades, two of your worst trades. But before we jump in, it's our tradition to learn a little bit about your background. So where did you grow up and what were you like as a kid?
I would describe myself as dirty and outside all the time. I never wore shoes. I was always in a, you know, spent probably a third of my life in a magnolia tree in the yard, and I was always outside and running around. So
a free spirit. Were you into sports, or were you always sort of into academics? What were your interests? How'd you spend your time?
I definitely like sports. My father is a musician, so I also played a lot of musical instruments growing up, and I was the stand-up bassist for my high school's orchestra, which was pretty cool. Given I'm, you know, petite, you know, I'm about 5'3" on a good day.
Instrument.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an interesting way to start, given where your career took you. Did you have an awareness of money from a young age, or markets? Was that something that was discussed in your house?
Oh no, not at all. My parents were like, don't know anything about markets. Didn't have any ties to Wall Street. I had never even been to New York until, you know, I started interviewing for Wall Street jobs. So it was totally, you know, out of what I grew up with.
So how did it get on your radar? Like, when did you first become aware of it?
Well, I had an academic scholarship to college. So I was, I had an academic ride, and then a lot of my friends would, you know, go out to dinner, and I wanted to go out with other kids. And so I had a job all through college. Through my job, like once I realized I could work off campus and get paid a lot more and do something more interesting, I started to, because of my job, wanted to learn about derivatives, because we were using a lot of swaps in, I worked for a management consulting firm. It was, I was an intern there, but I was paid, and I was working, you know, probably 40 hours my last 2 years. And I had to learn about derivatives for my job. And that's kind of how I fell into it was, and then I started trading myself. I think I probably looked a little different when I didn't know anybody. I came to Goldman Sachs right out of college. I didn't know anyone at the firm. I had never even been to New York. I just sent my resume in on the internet.
Yeah, back then, you remember that before LinkedIn.
So, I know, right?
Were you in math classes in college that you were sort of working? So you're in DC, I think, at this time, right?
Yeah, I was in DC. And I took a bunch of, because I had like a day job, I was taking a lot of night classes. And because I was an academic scholarship kid, I was in what they call the honor program. So I could take classes in any of the different universities. And I ended up taking 5 grad classes, which is kind of how I got into the derivatives markets. And I just thought it was so fascinating. And I was really fortunate that one of my professors was you know, LBO banker and kind of helped me a little bit about, you know, I remember when I was applying to these different firms, he was so funny. He, you know, I got an offer from Goldman. He's like, you should take that. And I said, well, I have these other offers and I was going through the other firms. He's like, no, Goldman's the best. You should go there. So
yeah, you need some guidance if you're flying blind, because this is, you know, this is before, I remember when we were going, because I have a daughter who's kind of going in the beginning of the college process now. And I tell her all the time, like, we didn't know anything, you know, like we never visited schools. We ended up there. And even the job process, you just did not have sort of the amount of information and social media and all these other things to fill you in. So it was kind of like flying blind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's but I think in a way it's good because then you can really listen to what people tell you who are more experienced. And I think maybe now it's a little harder because you have so much information. It's tough to know who to listen to because you're like information overload. So
yeah. So that that Goldman interview process must have been a doozy. We've had a couple Goldman alumni on. Sergio Silva was one of them who told us about his like 400 interviews that he had to go through to get.
I
think that was
400.
When he was an intern. exaggerating, but it's a pretty brutal process. What did you make of your first sort of impression of Wall Street?
You know, it was definitely, I had read about the stress interviews and I kind of was like, I'm great at math, like bring it on. You know, I was sort of like a, you know, in it to win it kind of mentality. And, I don't know, I just kind of took it in stride. And I think I was always pretty self-confident, even when I was a college student. So I sort of was like, I know my stuff, you know. But I think once I got into the firm, it definitely felt a little like I wasn't from an Ivy League school. I think a lot of the other analysts, and even when I went through the associate program, there were, you know, I was kind of an outlier in terms of, you know, my path getting there.
Yeah, this isn't one of your trades. It's a bonus trade, but I understand that there's a lucky green dress that you feel like played a role in your Goldman journey. Tell me about that.
Well, so I took the train up to New York for my first Goldman interview. I wore this dress that I bought literally at TJ Maxx. It's green and stretchy, and it was great for the train. And I guess I'm, you know, knock on wood, very fortunate that I can still wear that dress because in the middle of the pandemic, so March 2020, I was invited by the New York Stock Exchange to ring the closing bell. And it happened to be the worst down day in the U.S. equity market since the 87 crash. The market was just falling. And I knew it was falling when I, you know, left to go to the stock exchange for the close. And so I'm looking at my closet and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to wear my lucky green dress. So I'm very fortunate. It's stretchy. It can still fit me. And yeah, if you Google, it's kind of cool. It's on the internet. If you Google my name, you know, and then hottest ETF, you'll see a picture of the green dress from, and then the next day it was, I believe it was the middle of March, 2020. The next day, the New York Stock Exchange completely shut down and went all electronic. So I was actually the last person to ring the bell before they shut down.
Which is absolutely crazy. And crazy that, you know, something plays a role in both of those really pivotal times in your life. You know, we were joking about calling it a lucky dress, but I wonder, the subject of luck comes up a lot in these interviews. How much do you think that luck plays a role and skill plays a role?
I think both play a role, but I do consider myself a very lucky person. I had a tremendous amount of opportunities. I was with the right people. I've had a lot of support over my career, over my life. So I do, you know, feel very lucky. And I know Goldman, especially on the prop desk, you know, I joined the prop desk very early on. I spent about 7 years with Goldman Props, about 10 years with the whole firm. And in the prop desk, we were always very superstitious. You know, there was no red. Red is the color of losing money. Green is the color of making money, hence my green dress on the worst down day in the U.S. equity market. I was like, stop the nonsense. This is overdone. But yeah, we, you know, no red nail polish, no red ties, no red pens. You know, I guess I've always been a little superstitious and somebody who believes that inherently I'm a pretty lucky person.
That's amazing. I didn't realize there was that. I'm not surprised though, but I didn't realize there was that level of superstition.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it's like Goldman, who pride themselves on their skill, you know? So, but I guess everyone falls victim to that.
Yeah. That was Eric Mindich back in the day. He was the one who kind of started the like no red thing.
I love it. I wonder if they're still doing it. Goldman people, call us up, let us know if that's still a rule. As you were making your way through Goldman, I mean, that's a pretty cutthroat firm. We've all heard stories. How did you navigate that? How did you find that whole experience?
Well, I had a wonderful time.
Did you end up as head of credit derivatives and OTC trading? That's no small thing.
Yeah. Thanks. Again, I do feel like I was very, very lucky to be in the prop desk because at the end of the day, you had a number next to your name and it was very, very flat organization. There weren't a lot of politics. I always tell other women, like, it's a great place to be as a trader or a portfolio manager because you can really cut through the bullshit and the politics. And so I was, I think it was 2003 when I was promoted to be the head of credit, derivatives, and OTC trading for the Goldman prop desk. And I ran the group for about 5 years before I went to JP Morgan's hedge fund. And it was a wonderful place to be. I had both my children at Goldman when I was, came back for both of them after maternity leave. And I just had a wonderful experience. And, I was very honored because recently Goldman had a women's conference in London and they'd actually had me in as a speaker. I was one of the few, people outside the firm as an alum, but yeah, I had a wonderful time there. I loved the firm. It was the best culture and such a great training ground.
Hey everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear because it's hard, especially when you're trying to juggle family. A lot of people step out. It's, the broken rung. A lot of people step out. It's really hard to kind of find your way back in. So it's amazing that you did it, but also that you found that you were supported in that. So let's jump into your first trade.
Yeah.
And it was a good one. And I believe this is when you're at Goldman, but you'll tell us. And that was in 2011. So maybe you weren't, I'm not sure. Being on the other side of the London whale trade. So set the scene for us. Like, are you at Goldman? Where are you? What's happening at work and at this time of your life?
Yeah, so I was not at Goldman for this. I was at a 1940 Act mutual fund, and I didn't know that it was the other side of the London whale trade. I had no idea that was coming or what it was, but we were, long only credit. And as, all the credit funds had a tremendous amount of exposure to credit spreads widening and correlation increasing, I was looking at the tranche market and saw, IG9 super senior tranches were like super cheap. So you could buy protection to benefit when credit spreads widening and when correlations increased, which is exactly, as a long-only mutual fund, when the funds actually lost money. So I was running around trying to put IG9 super senior protection in all of these portfolios across the firm. And it was pretty exciting. I had to actually go to the board meetings, change the prospectuses of the mutual fund because derivatives were not allowed. And so it was definitely a huge learning experience for me to be able to try to communicate to the board what we were trying to do and why it was a good fiduciary thing to do and why it was good for the fund investors and having that communication. I actually still keep in touch with some of the board members. I actually emailed one of the guy who used to be the chair of the board last week. And so that was, 10 plus, 12 years ago. And so it's really cool to make those relationships and then continue them. So
what was the reaction when you were going around to these boards? Because it sounds like you were seeing something that other people were not, and you had to sort of convince them to see what you were seeing. What was the reaction when you first started going to them? Because like people don't like change, especially when you have to change like the bureaucracy of something like a prospectus.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was seeing was like, look, we're a long only fund, and this is a way of protecting in case of recession or, that was when Greece was happening and the whole European crisis. And so there was a lot of turbulence in the world and interest rates were still, basically at zero. And so I didn't know it ended up being the other side of the London whale trade. But I remember going to my boss and saying, I've heard these things about JP Morgan. I don't think they know about it. Can I go tell, Jess Staley? Because I used to work with him when I was at JP Morgan at their hedge fund. And so I knew people at JP Morgan from when I was a portfolio manager at their hedge fund strategy. So it wasn't part of the sell side. It was just a private fund. Mm. But yeah, it turned out, I remember my boss sent me a really funny email the day that the JP Morgan news, the London whale trade, I didn't know it was called the London whale trade, but he said, something I'm paraphrasing, but I have egg on my face. You were right. I can't believe it.
So, oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, that was for those who may not have been around when that was happening. It was shocking. And also everyone thought that nothing like that could happen after all of the things that took place in the great financial crisis. And in 2000, there were so many regulate, there was so much that happened in banking that for something like that to go down was sort of, it sent shockwaves through everything. So did you have anybody who doubted you or resisted you or thought like, oh, this isn't necessary? Did you get a lot of pushback or did people kind of come around to this idea that needed to be hedged? Because there's a lot of talk right now about people who are not sufficiently hedged. But yeah. Back then, was it an easy sell or, did you really have to convince some people?
I mean, it kind of depends. Like everybody's different. I definitely remember periods in my career where things were so obvious. Like when I worked at JP Morgan's hedge fund, I had Volkswagen options. I was long optionality in Volkswagen because Volkswagen Ball was cheaper than dollar yen. It was like the cheapest. It was a single stock ball that you could buy for single digits. And I remember going around the firm, I already had it in my portfolio, but going around the firm specifically to the convert desk who, by nature, convert desks are always short stocks. And I was like, look, convert this thing into puts because the ball is so cheap. And so I remember doing that. And like, definitely that was frustrating because a lot of people did not listen to me. And they were like, well, it's realizing 4 and it's priced at 6. So that's a really extreme premium. I was like, are you crazy? Like, dollar yen ball's 10 and this is 6. So I've definitely had points in my life where I've saw things and implemented it myself, but trying to convince others is really a skill that I would say I'm not particularly good at. I have a lot of conviction with my things, but convincing other people to do things is not, I'd say, my skill set. But in terms of the buying super senior protection, I was able to convince several portfolio managers to add it, but then several others who did not. So, I think all you can do is control your own portfolio and then tell people about what they're doing and let them make their own decision.
Yeah. It's funny that you think you're describing it as something that's not your skill set, because I think there are an awful lot of people who are early who would tell you that it has to do with a lot of other things as opposed to the person telling them. You know, sometimes people just don't want to hear things for a variety of reasons. So what do you think the takeaway was from this? I mean, first of all, what was your reaction when you found out that you were on the other side of these trades? Because you didn't know for most of the time, right?
No, I didn't know at all. It's really hard in the moment to know like who's on the other side, especially when you're not in a customer. You know, I hadn't really been on a customer desk since like, you know, my early days at Goldman. I was on the sell side. But afterwards, I was always on the buy side. And you don't really know who the flows are. You don't have that information. And so I think it's more of just looking for opportunities, looking for attractive convexities, looking for things that might potentially be mispriced. And I've always been somebody who just loves buying, you know, cheap options and being kind of anti-consensus, I guess you could say. Like when everybody is, you know, worried about something, I like to, you know, take the other side or vice versa. And so that's kind of been, I guess, as somebody who focuses on, you know, the asymmetric part of the derivatives market. So I don't use any linear derivatives like futures, forward swaps, all of those go up a dollar, but they go down a dollar. I'm not a big fan of linear derivatives. I only like the asymmetric derivatives. So options specifically, and I like to buy options, which is weird in itself, Maggie. You know, 99% of the world, all they do is sell options. And so I've always felt like I've had this different way of constructing portfolios. But to me, it's like such a no-brainer. I'm like, everybody is trying to lose money with their options, right? If you think about it, like everybody has their portfolio and then they sprinkle the options, either sell them and hope they expire, or they buy them for hedges, but nobody's actually trying to make money off the options. So to me, it seems like a, you know, very obvious, like that's a great place to add alpha. But, you know, I've always thought about things a little differently.
Yeah, clearly. That's amazing. So and it's interesting in context of your next trade, which is one of your worst, and it's being short Japan. And so we'll just say in both of your worst trades, they're trades that have frustrated you over long periods of time. But let's start with Japan. Why does this make the list?
I mean, there's so many reasons that, you know, Japan is sometimes called the widow maker. So I've, yes, over the course of my career, tried to short Japan in all sorts of ways, whether it was payer swaptions in the rates market or, you know, JPY FX options or Nikkei or dispersion. You know, Japan is just always frustrating because there's fundamentals and then there's Japan. And Japan, you know, has just been, you know, something that's been very hard. I think, you know, obviously the central bank has been manipulating their markets for a long time. They've been in significant deflation for a very long period. Like even now, it blows my mind. Like I look at Japan's doing still yield curve control, and their yield curve is about positive 50. When you look at the twos, tens, JGBs or twos, tens, JPY swaps, positive 50, where the US is like massively inverted still. So to me, I'm just like, what in the world? That makes no sense that the US is so negative and Japan is positive. But Japan's definitely been like over time, just incredibly frustrating because I always want to short it and I'm never, you know, sometimes you can get good carry because depending on what currency you pair it against, if you're long a higher yielding currency, I guess my most success with Japan is having the carry currencies versus Japan, but rates, forget about it. It's like so hard to make money there. And then the equity market just really is distorted because of the central bank's activities.
Yeah. Why do you think you kept going back? Or you know, because it's been multiple times you've tried all different kinds of things. Why not just throw in the towel and say, Japan, forget it?
It's cheap ball. Like it goes back to, you know, I like cheap ball. And, you know, it gets really cheap sometimes because, you know, so owning cheap optionality is always something that is a little, you know, it's a little thing that keeps me coming back.
So. Are you ever tempted to try again?
You know, I think at some point, definitely. But right now I'm doing 40 ACK funds that have very clear prospectuses, and Japan has not eaten any of our funds. So not at the moment.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Maybe in Nancy's private life one of these days. It sounds like the one that got away, you know? Can't crack the code. It's frustrating.
I know, right?
So one of your other trades in a similar fashion that ranks as your worst is gold. And this is another one that you just been frustrated with time and time again. Are there similarities to the Japan trade? Like, why? What is it about gold that puts it in the worst?
Yeah, I think, you know, I, especially after the financial crisis, really was one of those people that the Fed doing QE and printing all this money is going to be very inflationary. And so I've had gold in my portfolio and my personal account for really since, you know, I'd say 2009. And with the exception of like certain periods, it really doesn't do anything. And so I've had all different ways of constructing long gold. I think probably the most clever was against Swiss franc. So you can actually own gold in FX form. It's called XAU. So I had long XAU versus the Swiss franc, which was a negative yielding currency. So it actually made gold a positive carry position. But then the Swiss francs, you know, the central bank kind of messed that up. So fortunately it was just options, but you know, it's definitely just been one of those very frustrating trades. And I actually did a lot of academic research on what is gold, because some people say, oh, gold is an inflation hedge. And I think I really did believe that probably initially. And now I'm solidly in the camp of gold is, you know, definitely a fiat currency trade. It's definitely FX. It's definitely psychology, but I don't think it is an inflation hedge. And I know we'll probably get lots of comments from all the gold bug and, you know, bring it on. I love all the hate that I get. But, I have done the work and would be happy to send out our papers on gold being a lot of things, definitely a fiat currency, definitely psychology, but it's not an inflation hedge.
That's so interesting. And you're absolutely right. We get questions about it constantly in the shows we do because of the situation we're in and because people are looking for that sort of safe haven harbor. Yeah. And they think that's the way to protect itself. I'm laughing when you're like, hey, bring it on. You
well,
clearly,
I just know the comments.
I know.
People are crazy with gold. So it's...
Well, you could maybe just stop with people are crazy, because if it doesn't fit into their... right now, people are very tribal about whatever it is they believe in. They're very fixed on that. But it sounds like you're really comfortable being a contrarian. Like, you're okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I sort of think doing what everybody else is doing is a little boring. So I like naturally enjoy, you know, when everybody's worried about one thing, the other side is usually cheaply priced in terms of volatility, and being kind of a long option, long ball person, I think it plays to my personality and something I enjoy doing. I think it also gives you a lot of staying power. You know, when you use a long option, I think of it as like a debit card. You know, the most that you can lose is the premium that you spend. Mm-hmm. And then you have time, depending, you know, sometimes we use really long dated options and you can wait, you know, you can have a lot of, you know, like I remember with even like with Volkswagen, like the thing everybody was shorted, it ripped to the moon and then it fell. But it was all about staying power. So I think options give you, when you're long options, not short options, but when you're long options, you have that staying power because the most that you can lose is the premium that you've allocated to that trade.
Yeah. We're going to have to get you to do an academy session for us, Nancy, because this is something that I think a lot of people, they want to use more, but you know, it's intimidating if you haven't been sort of, you know, in that market. I'm curious, how do you tell the difference between being contrarian and just being wrong?
That's a good question, Mary. I mean, it's all timing, right? And I think that's one thing that, you know, taking a lot of traders out there, whether they're systematic or CTAs or trend followers, a lot of people are doing similar things. You know, they buy, you know, to simplify things, they buy what's going up, they sell what's going down. But the big problem with those sorts of things is liquidity and being able to execute in a linear derivatives market like the futures market. You're kind of relying on liquidity. And so I think, you know, definitely with long options, you can be wrong for a lot longer. I think it's a lot more forgiving than something that's a linear derivative. Like if you think about using a future or forward or swap, it goes up a dollar, but it can also go down a dollar. And so you can have even like the UK, they had a margin call on linear derivatives. They were receiving rates, meaning basically being levered long bonds with swaps. And then they got a margin call where they had to turn around and sell their collateral. And so I think you can be wrong for longer if you use long options. There definitely is pain involved in the meantime, but I think it gives me a lot of comfort with the way that we're investing. And again, remember, I think most people are not using options as part of their portfolio. Options are the periphery of the portfolio. For us, the options are that core piece of the portfolio. And so I think it's just, it's different, you know, it's a different way of thinking about investing.
Yeah. And you know, maybe one better left to the professionals, but I like to understand what, you know, even if I'm leaving it to other people, I think it's fascinating to hear you talk about it because I think it's good for us to have an understanding of it. I'm curious, like when I hear you talk, it's almost like you see the world like this. Like you can see when I hear people talk about options in depth, it seems to me to be a 3D map that you guys see, but then the rest of us don't because we don't know how to read it. Does it feel like that to you? Like when you were at that management consulting, that first job, when you were exposed to derivatives, did you sort of immediately understand it? Like, is it something that was a native understanding to you, or did you have to sort of work to make sense of it?
Yeah, no, I took 5 grad classes, and those that was all transfer pricing with swaps. It was all linear derivatives. I just kind of, as I learned more about the derivative markets and just kind of got more in the weeds, I actually just fell in love with options. I know that's like a weird thing to say, but it really is a passion of mine. And I knew that, you know, sometimes when you go into a career, you kind of think like, oh, maybe it's luck, or maybe I just, you know, ended up here. I actually was a full-time stay-at-home mom by choice when my kids were really little, in that 0 to 3 bucket. As an investor, I really wanted to be home with them. So I was a full-time stay-at-home mom for 3.5 years. And strangely, it was actually in that period where I was like, I really love options. Like I used to go, my kids, I know it's like that time that you get to like really like pause and say, what do I do in my free time? Like, how do I spend my time? What like gets me fired up? And it was not normal. Like, you know, most stay-at-home moms, when their kids are in the twos program and they have, you know, you have 2 hours a day to yourself when they're in the little, like the 2-year-old program. So it's just like a preschool thing. And I used to go to the Greenwich Library and use their Bloomberg terminals, and I would price up structured products on the secondary market, which was, you know, all convertible bonds with options. And I would trade in my like little 2-hour window a day, which was not normal. Like, you know, other my friends were going to Le Pan Quotidien to have coffee together, or they were playing pickleball, or they were going grocery shopping, or they were going to Whole Foods. You know, I had no interest in shopping, no interest in socializing. You know, I like to trade my my structured products, and that was weird.
I can't even imagine what the librarians must have been thinking. Like, they were like, who is this person that comes sliding in? I mean, I would have loved to fly on the wall.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it was a nice time in my life to be like, I actually love doing this because I do it in my very small amount of free time. Like when you have two toddlers and a baby, you know, I had a toddler and a baby. It was not, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to myself. And I was like, I really saw it as my job. Like I had no nannies, no babysitters. Like I was all in being, you know, I guess whatever I do, I want to do it really well. Like if I'm going to cook dinner, I want it to be like freaking awesome. Like I want everything to be perfect. I guess I'm like a pretty intense person. And I took the same approach to parenting. Like I was like, I'm not hiring babysitters. I'm not hiring nannies. Like I'm all in. But I think seeing myself, you know, doing option trading for fun in my free time was really a good reality check to be like, I did get lucky because I fell into something that I loved. But I also, before I got to Goldman, I was using options in my own portfolio. I was investing in them in college. You know, that's kind of weird. But, you know, I think whatever floats your boat, I think in life, if you can find something that you love to do and try to build a career around something that you enjoy doing personally, that whatever it is, I think that's kind of the way to be successful, because it doesn't feel like work, right? It's something you actually like doing.
Yeah. And you really have to have that attitude if you're going to have any sanity. You must have been the only in the room a lot though. I mean, you know, especially for something like derivatives. I mean, there are more and more women in investment banking, but I cannot fathom back at that time that there were a lot of women doing derivatives.
Yeah, no, definitely at the Vol conferences. So the volatility conferences, you know, I feel like a rock star, you know, everybody knows who I am. And you know, it's weird. Like I think it's all your perception on how you look at things. Like some people could be like, oh, I feel really awkward because I'm the only, you know, blonde wearing pink ruffles and flower earrings in a room. But for me, I was like, yeah, I always kind of was like, I deserve to be here and everybody knows who I am. And to me, it was kind of cool. Like, but I also hired, you know, a lot of women and a lot of other people over the course of my career as I got more senior to build more diversity. But definitely the derivatives and vol world is pretty small. But I always felt like a really big fish. So yeah. It's good.
You used it to your advantage. You used it
I think it's all your mindset too. It's like whether you look around and you see nobody else that is necessarily like you, and whether you think, you know, hey, I'm lucky to be here, or whether you're like, I don't belong. For me, I was always like in the I'm happy to be here camp.
Yeah. And in all your travels, you never felt that you were underestimated or that it was somehow held against you or people doubted you, your credentials more?
No. I was very fortunate to have, you know, to be on Goldman's prop desk in the 2000s when we were probably the largest prop desk in the world. And I ran the largest options book in the world. So like, I don't want to sound arrogant, but
everybody knew
who I was.
They better know.
I was like Madonna in the ball world. They're like, oh, that's Nancy. I never felt that way.
I love it. I love it. So your fourth and final trade is one of your best, and that's in 2019, the day you listed Quadratics ETF iVol. So this is amazing. Give us a little background on this. What, at some point you made the decision, you had been working for sort of larger firms, some of the largest, obviously, as we just discussed, but large firms in investment banking. Why did you decide to make this move?
Well, I think it really goes back to when I started my career in the late 90s at Goldman. It was right when the U.S. Treasury Department issued TIPS. So these are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And I remember being a young trader and being like, that is so not going to work. You know, they're bonds. So all TIPS are long duration. So they all lose money. Even a short duration bond is still long. It's just, it really should be called less long. So it's like TIPS are all long duration. And then the only index, which I think is really important to think about, is CPI. And the consumer price index is not even an index that the Fed uses. So why would you only measure inflation with CPI? And so for me, it was always sort of a lifelong career passion of mine to fix the TIPS market. And so what Eyeball is, it takes a portfolio, which is about, you know, 80% typically, sometimes 85% in that type of treasury bond. So we take TIPS and then we fix the problems with long options. And so for me, it was just one of those like innovations. I think there's not a lot of in asset management, a lot of the strategies are the same old thing, you know, plus or minus 25 basis points, the same indices, the same kind of group think. And so for me, it was really a solution. And I think that that was exciting to be able to have my own firm and to say, look, this is a problem. People don't realize that the ag index is got no inflation protection in it. They don't realize that the ag index, a third of it is mortgages, and mortgages are short volatility because homeowners are on the option to prepay. We saw that recently when Silicon Valley Bank had those issues. It was because mortgages, homeowners are rational. And when interest rates go higher, they don't prepay as quickly. And then the mortgage extends their duration right when the bond investor is losing more and more money as interest rates move higher. So it's always the same story, but I think it was super exciting for me to be able to see a problem in the market, create a financial innovative way of fixing it and putting it into a single CUSIP product. I mean, I think I look at the mortgage market and I'm like, someone, you know, that had to be CUSIP'd, it had to be investable. And I feel like I've done that with Eyeball, and Quadratic has, and Crane, my ETF partner. We've innovated in the space by making a single CUSIP product in a market that was previously really not accessible for people because it is an OTC market.
Yeah, that's amazing. By the way, Nancy and I did a whole kind of deep dive on this issue, kind of anchored in current conditions. Which I highly recommend you go back and look at, because sort of right after we talked, it was so prescient because so much happened in the wake of that, that really, I think, brought to life a lot of what Nancy's talking about more broadly here. And I'm sure we'll sit down for an update on it again, because what I always like is that you're identifying sort of the risks that you saw out there that were underappreciated. And this is the thing that sort of blows everything up, you know, again and again. What's been the hardest part of having your own firm and sort of giving birth to this ETF? What was something that was hard that you didn't anticipate?
You know, the ETF world is an oligopoly. It's really controlled by three large firms. And I think one thing I did not appreciate, or maybe I was a little naive, or, you know, sometimes you need a little bit of rose-colored glasses as an entrepreneur, is I didn't realize how competitive it was and how hard it is to get approved at these wealth management platforms. Like, you actually have to go and they have to like do due diligence on you and approve you to allow people to buy an ETF, like, which seems bizarre to me. Like, I mean, if it's a listed security, it's listed on the stock exchange, why do you need all these approvals? But a lot of the firms, you know, are pretty like in your face about like, we only look at the largest ETF issuers. We do not look at smaller firms. We, you know, just don't bother. And I think that's been, I want to shake them and be like, well, why the hell not? You know, like, yeah. What's wrong with you? Like, why wouldn't you want something that's different, that's innovative? But I think that's been the biggest frustration, is kind of fighting, you know, Eyeball is not approved at large, you know, certain large wealth management firms. We're still, you know, fingers crossed. I'm hoping that, you know, the fund just turned 4 years old. We paid out 30 basis points every single month since the fund started paying distributions in July 2019. And I'm hoping that, you know, this will be kind of the next wave to kind of get it more, you know, to compete with the bigger oligopoly firms. But the ETF industry is definitely the most competitive, the hardest to break into. And it's really an access problem where you need to get the wealth management firms to allow you on the platform. And that has been something that's pretty challenging and frustrating and something I'm still working on, but I'm optimistic, Maggie. I think we'll get there.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it is the way that sort of individuals can access things. So it's sort of strange that what should be, you know, open to all, and that was the whole idea of it, has this sort of traffic jam, if you will, in the middle. How have you found being an entrepreneur? Do you like that? Is that a muscle you knew you had?
You know, I love being an entrepreneur, and I definitely have, you know who you are. I have a whole, I'd say, like, my peeps out there that I have convinced to leave their day job, start their own business. And it's across industries. Like, I have friends that are, no matter what industry that you're in, if you love what you do things differently, and you're creating a solution for people. I think it all comes back to, like, if you're a solution, you should do it. And so I've really, you know, had so much fun being an entrepreneur and also bringing other people onto the entrepreneurial side. And I just get a lot of love in my life from doing that and helping others and motivating people, whether it's in finance or outside of finance in different venues, different types of businesses. But I have absolutely loved being an entrepreneur. I've actually been working for myself since 2013. So I've actually been working for my own firm as an entrepreneur, self-employed, longer now than I was at Goldman Sachs. So I'm very—
That's wild.
Yeah, I'm fingers crossed for the next decade, but I'm super excited about it. I love building a business. I love creating a firm, and I'm looking forward to what the future holds.
That's amazing. So we started off talking about you sort of hanging out of trees and covered in dirt all the time, but are there people, you know, family, friends early in your life who look at you now and say, like, this is— are they surprised at what you ended up doing? Is it sort of, you know, hilarious to them that you end up this, you know, Wall Street sort of titan and owner of your own business?
You know, it's so funny, but I honestly don't think anyone in my family is impressed with me. I think they're all, you know, like, whatever.
You're the boring person at the dinner table talking about options.
I know. A lot of people in my family are physicians. They're doctors, and I think I've always been a little bit of a disappointment to some of my family members because I'm not curing cancer. I'm not helping people. I'm involved in dirty things like money. You know, but I have to say, like, when I'm on, you know, if I do like the Real Vision with you or television or any kind of thing, like, nobody watches it. Like, nobody cares in my family. Like, I get no props from anybody. But in a weird way, I kind of wonder whether that's been what's driven me, because I've definitely been a self-starter. Like, I'm not doing this to impress my parents. I remember, you know, I probably will not name which person this is in my family, but basically, I don't know, it was around probably 2019 when we had listed iVol. It was the first of its kind ETF. It's the first long interest rate vol product, you know, in the US ETF market. I was, you know, feeling like super pat on my back. And one of my, you know, parents told me maybe I should go back to Goldman Sachs and get a real job. You know, like, I kid you not. I was just like,
it's so funny though. That's it's common. It's more common than you think, because it's come up multiple times, especially the physician, a lawyer makes the family happy. And then otherwise they're like, I don't really get what you do, but okay, yeah. But I don't really get it. But that's— it's just okay. Probably generational.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, people are like, oh, your parents must be so proud of you. I was like, no, I don't think so.
Well,
but
thank
it's
goodness
okay.
If they knew that you were one name, Nancy, the Madonna of finance, you may not be bearable to be in a room with. So it's maybe it's good you have people keeping you down to earth.
I know, right? They keep me humble. So my children are so good at keeping me humble. You know, I'm sure you'll appreciate this, Maggie. I was on Bloomberg TV recently, and I am not a good dresser. I guess you could say, like, I'm just not, like, I don't have that fashionista about, you know, I'm wearing no shoes right now. Like, I'm like, no shoes are the best shoes. You know, I just don't have that. And so I sent the video after it was on to my son, and he wrote me back. He's like, Mom, you look like an airline stewardess. Like, I had this scarf on, and I was like, thank you. You know, keep me humble.
I love it. They're the harshest critics, always.
I know. And he was totally right. Like, I absolutely did look like, you know, I was a flight attendant.
Well, dressing may not be your superpower, Nancy, but certainly everything else is in the investing world. And we're super grateful for that and that you come on and share it with us. Thank you so much for being on My Life in Four Trades.
Thank you, Maggie. It's great to see you. I really appreciate you having me on.
It's a fantastic journey and should be inspirational to everyone. And thanks to all of you for joining. As usual, take care and good luck out there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.